My name is Mojan Bezadi, and I'm the curator of Trajectories, a series of conversations with Montreal artists from various backgrounds. Through in-depth discussions, I invite you to discover these artists who address the subjects, themes, and formal approaches that are central to their practices. Each dialogue begins with the revelation of an artwork or experience that the artist has encountered at the Montreal Museum of Fine Arts that has had an impact on them. From that point forward, we begin to draw a trajectory through each artist's universe. Hello, I'm in the studio today with artist Juan Ortiz Apuy, who is a Montreal-based artist, and I'm so glad to have him with me here today. Hi, Juan, how are you?
Hi, Mojan, I'm doing good. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for being here. So I'm very excited to hear the object or the artwork that you chose in the museum's collection from the invitation I sent you to choose one. Which object did you end up choosing?
It was a very hard decision to make because there's so many different things that I like there. There's literally hundreds of objects. And then I really debated between an artwork, a design object, or an artifact. And then it was really hard because there's just one object that you need to pick. It takes me a long time to make decisions. So I thought about it for a long time. But I decided to pick an object from Costa Rica. The title of the object, it's called Jicote Polychrome Style Crocodile Shape Tripod Vessel. And it's a vessel that sits on three legs, on the legs of the crocodiles. So it has the shape of a crocodile as a base, and then a vessel-shaped top on top of it. And it's earthenware, and is from the year 1000 to 1300. And it's a really beautiful thing.
Wow. And what color is it? It's like an earthy color?
It's like an earthy color. It's earthenware, and it's painted as well. So it has this reddish color, mostly.
Wow. I could just, you said it was so difficult for you to choose the artwork, and I could only imagine knowing how much objects, you love objects and you work a lot with different, with a library of them, really, the way that you've described them to me. And also, this object that you chose reminds me the way that you described its legs, and it reminds me of something that you're working on right now with ceramics, where you afford you give objects legs and beaks and ears to kind of emphasize the sort of functionality that we give to objects. Can you speak a little bit about that?
For sure. I'm interested in this concept called affordances, which basically is about how an object tells you how to interact with that object. So a button would be round, and then it tells you the information for you to push on it, as opposed to a switch or a knob that you can turn. So handles do that. They tell you how to pick up an object and the kind of gesture that goes with picking up that object. So our beaks, for example. And I'm interested in that relationship between the object and the body. And I've been thinking about that for the body work that I'm doing right now. And then I'm also thinking that objects, a lot of the times, they have the risk of being relegated to their function. And that's something that I try to explore in my work and maybe try to highlight, that there's so much richness to an object aside from their function. So, for example, if I said, I can see that you're drinking coffee in front of me. So if I said to you, Mojan, what is that cup in front of you? What is it? What will you say?
What is the cup? It's a vessel.
But then I would say, well, that's its function, maybe, or that's the name, but that's not what the object is.
Yeah.
So then what else would it be?
Oh my gosh. It's a kind of ceramic ware.
But then I would say, that's a kind of description of the object, but not what the object is.
Yeah.
So then what
is
it?
Wow. It is happiness because it brings me energy right now.
I think that's kind of like what I'm interested in, is the impossibility of really knowing what an object is, because we're always perceiving objects through our human senses, right? So that's a filter that already happens. Mm-hmm. And I think objects are inaccessible in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. Now I'm having existential crisis for this cup. So I want to kind of explore with you a little bit more. You were describing this object and the kind of ceramics and what the body of work that you're working on right now, and maybe explore that a little bit further. You've also talked to me about mimesis and the sort of that being an interest of yours in how you explore objects. Can you talk a little bit about that as well?
For sure. Mimesis is a really interesting concept that I've been thinking about in relationship to advertising. I think that's one of the tricks under the hat of advertising, is to create objects or present objects, display objects, image objects in a way that they mimic something else. Usually that reference is to nature, so an anthropomorphic reference or a zoomorphic reference, to draw power from that reference into the object. If you walk through Dollarama, you would find lots of examples of objects trying to draw from the power of a waterfall or a coconut or a carrot or a duck. And I think that's the way that advertising and design, they aim to infuse something with more than what it is, in a sense. Like if you think about the journey from an object, from raw material, plastic or whatever it's made out of, onto it becomes a commodity. Along that process, there's a transformation that happens, right? The object gets infused with all of these desires and fetishes and dreams that we project onto it. So I'm interested in that.
Yeah, that's very fascinating. And we're going to get into it a little bit more. But I want to now take it back a little bit and to kind of ask you about your trajectory a little bit, this being the title of this podcast. You're from Costa Rica and you've lived in Montreal, in Glasgow, in Nova Scotia, where you've done your studies. How did you come back to root in Montreal, and why did you choose here as an artist, from your perspective as an artist?
Montreal is a really beautiful city. It's an easy decision. It's more or less home to me. Mm-hmm. It's the home that I adopted when I came here to study art, and then I moved away for grad school. But it always felt like not necessarily easy, but maybe easier to be an artist here than other places. I definitely appreciate the infrastructure that we have for supporting artists here, like funding-wise, like Calc or Canada Council. Also, renting studios, it's much more affordable than if you're living in Toronto or Vancouver or other places. So I like that. I think that's one of the main reasons why I felt like, being an artist in Montreal is definitely something that I can see myself being able to do, especially in comparison to Costa Rica, for example, where we don't have that infrastructure. We don't have artist-run centers, where you can apply and show your work. We don't have the same funding system and infrastructure. So yeah, I think it was thinking about those things. Plus, it's a really lovely place.
Yeah, totally. Well, where you're from in Costa Rica, I looked it up. And it looks like paradise, literally. It's so beautiful. And this is something that you carry into your work, either through the colors that you explore or some of the elements that you choose to bring up, like plants from back home, or is that a way keeping you connected to the place that you're from? How would you describe your relationship to Costa Rica as an artist?
That's a very complicated question. I mean, I feel like it informs everything that I do.
Yeah.
And so many of the decisions that I make are based, obviously, on that, on a background that we all have. Like, I feel like making art is more or less a personal journey for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And I feel like Costa Rica does that. Like, my sort of tendency to use plants or being interested in plants or animal forms or certain colors, I think they are shaped by the plants and the colors that I grew up with, which, as you mentioned, you know, very vibrant and quite beautiful. And all of those things, like, I find it really interesting because I don't feel like there are conscious decisions that I make. It's not like I set out to use those things intentionally, but they just, you know, I gravitate towards them as opposed to other ones.
Yeah.
But I think that's important. Like, I feel like it's important that art reflects who you are as a person, as an individual. And then, you know, that he says something about, you know, Juan or Mojan made that work and nobody else could have made it.
Yeah.
Because only you went through that personal trajectory.
Maybe we could talk a little bit about, you know, your work around ASMR. I'm really interested around what you've done, the recent videos that you've made, and how you came to be interested in that YouTube phenomenon, and how then you took that and brought it into your practice. Could you tell me the story behind that?
It's a good story, I think. I first learned about unboxing videos. That's what led me to ASMR. So I did a residency at the Vermont Studio Center 2017. And basically, I was watching unboxing videos for about 8 or 9 hours a day for like 35 days.
Mm-hmm.
So I watched a lot of YouTube, much more than I should have probably watched. And I thought it was a fascinating phenomenon. I thought it was, in a nutshell, about commodity fetishism. I thought that the way, or the fact that people can have that profound relationship to matter was fascinating, because people seem legitimately excited to showcase something to the world. You know, like, it wasn't, or it's not parody or irony. Like, people are just excited to understand that object, and that's why they stretch it. They, you know, they manipulate it. They take care in peeling the layers out of the object. Like, literally, the package that is wrapped on, and also metaphorically, I guess. And for me, who, you know, I was trained as a sculptor, that seems like an incredibly fascinating thing, that people can have that relationship to materials. So I first became really interested in that. And then I learned about ASMR videos, which, if you haven't heard about ASMR videos, they're like a cousin of unboxing videos. And it's where people pick up objects and they manipulate it very closely in front of a microphone to produce this physical sensation that, you know, it's supposed to produce in the back of your head. So in the way that they relate to materiality, to touch, to our interaction with objects, I feel like that's where all of those interests came up for me.
And it's interesting, I was listening you talk about the sort of ways that we in these videos that the objects are manipulated. And in some ways, that goes back to what we were describing about the cup at the beginning of the show, where it's like we're asking it more questions about what it is in that interaction, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, I feel like the question that I was really asking myself when I was watching unboxing videos is, why do people unbox?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought about that question for a long time, and I don't feel like I have an answer to it yet. I feel like partly it is because we are alienated from the means of production, so we don't normally understand how something is made, you know, at a fundamental level. So I think it is a way for people to maybe try to understand what something is or how it's put together. So that's part of it. The other theory that I came up with is, like, you know, there's an aura to an object when it's new. And I think there's something fascinating about that, about this idea that although it's not true, the object seems to don't have any signs or traces of, like, the hands that made it, or like human production, or like labor production. So it seems this kind of immaculate thing that is new. And the moment that you can reveal that, you know, that's the aura of it. And the moment that you, then it becomes a use object, then it sort of like loses that. So that aura of newness, of a new object, I think that's part of the drive to unboxing. But these are just theories, actually.
Yeah.
Don't know. Because, I mean, you would find people unboxing everything from a $2 big pen to like an $8,000 Gucci bag and everything in between. So it's not really about kind of luxury item, a kind of fetishism that happens with a luxury item. I think that's why it makes it a little bit more complicated.
It kind of reminds me of like gift receiving. And as a child, that moment of unwrapping a present and how much joy it brought, that you never lose that. Maybe it's just kind of inherently in all of us and remains in us as adults. And this is a way to explore that feeling that we all get when we open something new. And
yeah, I also think about, you know, like a future archaeology, for example. And I think about, you know, in 400 or 600 years from now, if we, you know, if somebody digs up something, what would that object be? And what would that say about us? You know, like what our relationship to material now would say about our culture and our material culture in the future.
Yeah. I want to play a clip from your recent video that you presented at Vox Centre de l'Art de l'Image Contemporaine called Tropicana, in which we could hear a little bit of this ASMR that you produced. Wonderful. Can you tell me a little bit about this sound and what you were trying to do here?
Well, it's a sound. I found garbage bags at this dollar store that they were called lavender-infused garbage bags, which just seemed like kind of crazy idea to me already because they are meant to be garbage bags. And then in manipulating the object, like opening the garbage bags, then, you know, I noticed how it sort of like sounded like rain. And that was part of the video. The video was about exploring how we can have this relationship to objects or exploring objects through sound and touch. And then I was interested in that paradox or that contradiction between the garbage bags and then the sound of rain, where if you can just hear the sound, it would seem like this natural thing. But obviously it's a very plastic, artificial thing. And I feel like it's something that the object is already doing. Like it has this like photograph of this like fresh sort of like lavender stock on you know, on the cover of the thing. And it is like, you know, it's a artificial smell, but it's like lavender infused sort of like. And I think that's, you know, like as we were talking about it yesterday, that's sort of like the magic tricks that advertising wants to pull off in order to portray something as, you know, natural and fresh and refreshing.
Yeah, and perhaps it's funny how, you know, we try to pull from nature in advertising to help people trust a thing that is otherwise just a manufactured object. It's important that association is incredibly important to the entire, you know, process of having us buy into it.
For sure. I feel like that's the ideology behind it. And then the tension that happens, obviously, is because the diversity of those products, like the amount of products that we have, you know, they thread the diversity that we have of, you know, natural specimens and plants. So they're like in this constant tension. So that's something that I think about, too. I think that also comes from being from Costa Rica, because it's, you know, as is more or less well known, it's a fairly green country that has a lot of like good policies in that sense, which are, you know, something else that we can talk about, because I have all kinds of conflicting feelings about that and ecotourism. But I feel like my interest in environmental concerns not only come from being a sculptor, because I feel like it is very hard to say that you're interested in materiality and objects and ignore the fact that there are giant patches of floating plastic in the ocean. Like, you know, those things, you have to acknowledge that.
Mm-hmm.
And then also from being from there, you know, growing up in a, you know, more or less fairly natural environment with that kind of thinking or outlook towards it.
You were talking earlier about archaeology of the future, but you're also looking at archaeology backwards in a different project right now that you're working on with back issues from the National Geographic, but not just back issues, like the entire archive of a certain period. Could you describe what you're exploring in this project and tell us a little bit more about this important inventory that you've gathered?
Well, I'm definitely a collector, a hoarder.
Yeah.
I describe myself as a hoarder, but I've always said that I'm a strategic hoarder because I just don't pick up anything, you know, like I make specific choices about what I want to accumulate. But in browsing around through Kijiji, which is one of my favorite places to acquire things sometimes, I found the entire collection of National Geographic for the 20th century. And it's actually, that's not true. I found 3/4 of it in one posting from somebody. And then I pieced it together with two other people. And now I have the entire collection of National Geographic for 100 years, so the 20th century. And it's an incredible thing because obviously you can see the history of photography being played out when you look through the magazines and the history of, like, you know, print and writing, and also not photography in only in the technical sense, but also in framing, right? In how you depict somebody and how you depict something. So long story short, I started thinking about doing a project with it, which is still, you know, in its infancy. I'm still sort of like working out what I want it to be and if it's going to work. But essentially, I have two studio assistants and we're cutting out all the images of people holding an object or presenting an object to the camera.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I have hundreds of images so far and we still have like so many boxes of magazines to go through. And the idea is that I'm going to bring those images into an animation of sorts where I can present each one of those images in a timeline and not put them side by side chronologically, but more by, you know, the way that the shift in the hand or the shift in the object kind of like goes, you know, there's a continuity in that so that I can create an animation. And then I want to turn it into a 16mm film projection where each one of the images will be one slide. And the duration of the film would be the amount of images collected in that magazine. It would be like 100 years of showing objects or presenting objects.
That's so fascinating. And it's you chose to not just the objects sitting on a table. It's really its relationship to the human hands. Could you say what it is about the object in a hand that interested you?
I'm fascinated by hands. I'm fascinated by the intelligence that goes with hands. I read this chapter called The Intelligent Hand by Richard Sennett, when he talks about how unique it is that we have a thumb movement, for example, which is as primate, I think it's only us that have that. And the richness of movement that allows us for you to handle something, twist something. And I think about that. I think about how you can think with your hands, for example. I always really like that in English you can say, or when you say to grasp something, means not only to hold something with your hands, but it can also mean to cognitively comprehend something. And the fact that those two things are kind of side by side in a way, like you are thinking with your body, you are thinking with your hands. So that on the one hand, no pun intended, on the other hand, I feel like the hands are just you know, there are that part of the body that handles things, that yeah. presents things, that manipulates things. So naturally, I feel inclined to explore them.
Yeah, yeah. It also goes back to the your interest in advertising and the language of advertising. I'm thinking of, I don't know if you know this artist, Christopher Williams, who does these like photographs that are highly staged with sometimes colors similar to the ones you use, like these bright, vibrant blues and these yellow pens and the hand holding them, and who really pulls similarly from the language of advertising.
I mean, I'm familiar with his work. I've seen some pieces in person for sure. I mean, it's not somebody that I actively research about because I mean, he is interested in advertising and display and structures of display, right? Not only the framing of the object, but also where that framing happens, like the background and the wall and the structure and all of that. But he's doing it from a history of photography too, which I'm not directly interested in. But definitely somebody whose work I admire quite a bit, and it's true. There's like some overlaps there, which I find exciting.
Yeah, totally. Speaking of artists who are maybe interesting in your own practice, who are some of the artists who you feel you are in a conversation with or that you respond to?
Well, those they change more or less on a monthly basis because I do have like artist crushes all the time, and then they just kind of rotate and then I move on. Mm-hmm. I do look at a lot of work. I do feel like my goal each time I make a project is to make it better than the one that I've made before. Mm-hmm. And I try to look at people who I admire and try to see what is it that makes that work good and strong.
Yeah.
And it's a difficult thing to know and to figure out, because when you look at it really closely, it's like, well, what is it exactly that made that project better than that other project, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe the answer, like knowing the answer is not what's important, but more or less following the question, that the question becomes a driving force, and then it makes you think about what is it that makes an artwork strong or stronger than the one that you made. So all that to say that I do look at a lot of people's work who I think are doing really exciting things. Right now, I'm thinking about Magali Ruiz, whose work I quite love. Mm-hmm. Jessica Stockholder, somebody whose practice I follow for a long time, but I keep sort of like going back to it. And I mean, I feel like she's been given definitely a lot of recognition, but sometimes I feel like she could be given even more recognition because I feel like her work is...
I've never heard of her.
Her work is kind of amazing. And she's also an educator. And I feel like her contributions not only to cultural production, but to, you know, education are immense. And she's a very dedicated...
Where is she based?
She taught at Yale School of Art for a long time. I don't know that she's teaching still. Actually, I think after Yale, she went to Chicago, and I think that's where she might be teaching right now.
Okay.
There's something incredible about the way that she manages to bring materials together, and I feel like that's almost like a philosophical, you know, problem, is how do materials encounter each other? How does wood encounter this little piece of metal, and how that piece of metal encounters this little piece of plastic? You know, I think that's a problem of architecture in a way. It's like how materials meet, but that's something that she does like really successfully. I've been thinking about Michael Smith, E. Smith, whose work is so intriguing to me. I find it really brave for the capacity of the work to occupy space by being small, like a small thing, but really fills the room in so many other ways.
Totally.
Mark Leckie, that's more than two, but yeah.
Oh, amazing. Yeah, Mark Leckie, I could see the relationship there. You, I think, feel like you would make great friends.
I feel like we would.
Yeah. You spoke about education, and you yourself started teaching visual arts at Concordia this last year in 2020, if I'm correct.
2020. Yeah. So this past fall was my first year.
Yeah. Online.
Online.
But could you tell me a little bit about your approach to pedagogy and your relationship to teaching so far, and what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I do have a lot of thoughts. I love teaching. I want to approach teaching with the same kind of intensity that I approach my art making. And I feel like those things are possible. I came here to Montreal to study art. There was one art program in Costa Rica back then in 1997 when I was trying to figure out what to do. And it wasn't a very good program. In big part due to that, but also the fact that I wanted to travel and go somewhere else, and I started looking into possible places where I can study art. I had a friend whose partner had gone to Concordia, and then I talked to them. They talked to me about Montreal, and it seemed like, you know, as good as any other place to me. And then I applied and got in, and I went through that program, and it changed my life, the sculpture program at Concordia. Like, it really, like, it introduced me to, you know, postcolonial theory, to critical thinking. It gave me this idea that creative thinking and critical inquiry, they're not just about objects, but you can use that as a philosophy, you know, for living life. Like, you can live your life creatively and critically. And it became such an important thing to me that I knew that I would want to come back and maybe try to offer some of that to other people. And maybe not the same kind of like life-changing experience, you know, because that expectation might be too high. But, do the best that I could to change people, to influence people, influence artists. And I feel like pedagogy can be a radical act on its essence. Like, the whole idea of, like, you know, I'll show you how to do something, and then you'll show me how to do something in exchange. I feel like that's a radical gesture.
Totally.
That's why I gravitate to it. That's why I love it.
Did you yourself have a teacher that was profoundly, or a professor who profoundly, you know, changed the course of your artistic practice, or an author who would have acted in the same way?
I did. I mean, I had my roster of authors that I was like completely fascinated with, and I was reading them in the bus or cooking or, you know, walking on the street. And I was really into Edward Said and Cornel West and bell hooks. I had great profs at Concordia. Nelson Hendricks, who still teaches there and is a friend of mine, he was a big influence for me. Cynthia Hammond also was. I think Cynthia Hammond introduced me to Edward Said.
Oh, very, very cool.
And then it made me really conscious of that, of the fact that you can introduce somebody to an author or an idea and how much that can have a repercussion on that person's life. You know, like I think about that retrospectively. Yeah. And try to bring that into the classroom when I teach as well. The possibility of doing that, maybe.
That's wonderful. I do want to talk to you about design and furniture. So you do objects, but you also do display. You create display tablets and furniture, and you've also done a residency at IKEA in Sweden, and I'm just fascinated. And we've also talked about, you're sourcing mid-century furniture for some of your future projects. Can you tell me a little bit about, you know, and it's coming from the same language, but as objects, but it's the furniture and how you relate to those, to that part of your practice.
Well, I, like we talked about it before, like I think about objects and how objects tell you information about themselves, even if that information is filtered. And then I feel like ultimately you can know what the object is, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's withdrawn from you. But then I also think about how you encounter that object and how you present that object, not only because of my interest in advertising. Like I think about how that object is literally like displayed for you mm-hmm. or image for you to create a certain kind of effect, right? Yeah. And then it makes me think about all the different ways in how an object presented under different circumstances would affect your perception or understanding of that object. So I was thinking about this the other day because I was reading in the park, which is mm-hmm. great, really nice thing to do.
Yeah.
And then I had my sunglasses next to me. And then I put my book down and then I was looking at my sunglasses and thinking about how I perceived the sunglasses. And then at that moment in time, which was a Sunday afternoon at about 3 o'clock, there was sunlight being reflected off of the lenses, also, mm-hmm. also off of the glass. And then it made me think, well, is that light part of the sunglass? Like, you know, like what is part of the object and what isn't?
Yeah.
And is that light part of the sunglasses? And then my perception of that pair of sunglasses, would it be different if it would have been an overcast day mm-hmm. or if it was at 7 p.m. at night? So how the circumstances in how we look at an object affect what that object is, or at least how we perceive it as well. Because mm-hmm. objects are never presented to us in a vacuum, right? Like yeah. even if we talk about my phone on this table, mm-hmm. like, well, I just said it, like it's on this table,
yeah.
you know, and it's in this room, yeah. in Montreal, in this yeah. neighborhood. Like they're never in a vacuum. They're always in relationship to other objects around them.
Yeah.
So that relationship, that context, I try to explore it for thinking about essentially how to present an object.
Yeah. And kind of help it maybe articulate something new or have a certain relationship.
Yeah. And then, well, and ideally also to make you as a viewer think about those things. Think about the lighting conditions, mm-hmm. the structure that actually supports the object, the, I don't know, atmospheric conditions, like anything that is influencing that perception of that object. Because I feel like learning that language, at least, for example, in my show at Vox, learning that language of presentation mm-hmm. can make you look at that same language critically.
Yeah.
You know, then you don't, you become aware of the tricks, you know, that they're using.
Yeah.
And at least for that show at Vox, that was part of the goal because it was intended for a youth audience. And it was about, you know, how can a youth audience develop the skills, or how can I promote those skills for thinking about advertising critically and thinking about that kind of like visual language critically.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like we all need a reminder, whether we're children or not. I mean, we tend to forget how we have consented as a society to this form of mind control, like that is advertising. It is kind of consensual. We're aware that this is supposed to influence us and we accept it.
Mm-hmm.
And but do we accept it in a sleepwalking way, or are we fully aware of what all of these things do to us? Yeah.
Well, I feel like, yeah, there's a lot of subconscious level messages that you get through that, which, I mean, there's a history of that, and there's a history of, design and marketing especially, you know, using that to its benefit.
Mm-hmm.
I forget the name of the person, but the nephew of Sigmund Freud was actually somebody who was really behind that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And that shaped a lot in how we looked at commercial language.
Yeah.
Yeah,
very interesting. Well, I do think you succeed in drawing our attention to that world. Okay, well, on that note, I want to thank you very much for spending this time with me talking. And I encourage our listeners to look you up and follow your next projects. Maybe I can ask you one last question. Is there anything coming up in Montreal in the next year that we should keep our eyes out for?
Not in Montreal, but I do have some exhibitions. Well, I have an exhibition in Wisconsin, so that's like not very far.
Yeah.
And then in the West Coast, so that's also not very far. And then some residencies. But not in Montreal, but hopefully soon. I am talking to somebody about the possibility of showing that 16mm film that we talked about from the National Geographic Project here in Montreal.
Okay.
So hopefully, you know, I can share that with people here soon.
Thank you so much, Juan.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure to talk to you and exchange ideas. And yeah, it's been fun. So,
same for me. Thank you. You just listened to Trajectories, a podcast produced by the Montreal Museum of Fine Arts in partnership with the Conseil des Arts de Montréal.